Welcome back to another edition of Old School Guns, the podcast that has the news, opinion, and answers that you want to hear. And as always, we are not sponsored by anyone, nor are we on anyone's network, so we're not being constrained by any evil outside forces. So let me just get right into it right here and start. Just kind of cruising through the news lines, I saw that I guess it's Boris Johnson, the newest guy who's in charge of the UK. I guess he's going to be Theresa May's replacement or whatever, or certainly a power broker there. He said war with Iran will not have British support. Well, frankly, I don't know that there's any support the British can give us. I mean, they're unfortunately a defunct, bankrupt country. You know, I just wonder if there is a Britain anymore. Has it become a just some sort of a world colony of people who have taken advantage of bad immigration policies? So, you know, and that's the kind of country that a lot of people want the United States to become, a bad example of how to manage your own borders, how to manage your own country and your own economy. So, consequently, I think, you know, I don't know that they can support anything. Yeah, I mean, and even they become just so goofy. I mean, the only stories that come out of Britain are, what did Prince Harry wear, and was it a faux pas, and what dress did Meghan Markle have for the Wimbledon thing? I mean, these just aren't serious people anymore. It's not a serious country anymore. It doesn't make any serious policy. I mean, they should be standing up to Iran. They should be. Iran is evil. Iran is a terrorist nation that supports every violent extremist jihadist group on the planet. And Britain should be standing up to them. And the fact that somebody would make a statement like this tells me they're not a serious player anymore. They're not to be taken seriously. It's a real shame. It's a real shame. 100 years ago, it was a much better place. I guess it's amazing to see how much the human mind and how people have changed just over a few generations. It's absolutely terrible. And speaking of something from 50 years ago, everybody's all wound up for the moon landings and talking about that, which is awesome. But another thing from 50 years ago, the LaBianca House. And that, if that sounds familiar to you, think of Charles Manson, the Tate LaBianca murders. Sharon Tate and her, she was basically holding a small get-together of a few friends. Well, they were all murdered. And a couple of days later, the LaBiancas, the LaBiancas owned a supermarket chain, and that's what Mr. LaBianca did for a living, and I think his wife was just a housewife. They were a middle-aged couple, lived in a fairly modest home in a very nice neighborhood in Los Angeles. And they were just randomly selected and murdered as a way for Manson to start his race war. And for anybody who remembers those times and remembers the kind of the background of that case, that was a big deal. And people then kind of knew that you might not be safe in your home. You know, until that happened, in a lot of places, people left doors unlocked. People didn't really worry about home security. There were no alarms that I'm aware of back then. People usually had, and I think gun ownership was probably at least as widespread as it is now, if not numbers, having a number of guns, but at least having a single gun in the house. And people were scared. It frightened everybody. You could live in a nice neighborhood, be a nice person, not offend anyone, and they could come after you and get you. And it was a big deal, and it weighed heavily on the public consciousness. The LaBiancas, you know, they're always kind of the afterthought footnote, kind of add-on story of the Tate murders. But it's one of those events that scared the hell out of everyone, and it's one of the reasons that that I think it still scares people, which is why the Manson killers have never been let out of prison. It was absolutely frightening, and it captivated the entire nation. Another thing that's very interesting, it kind of ties in with guns, but if you know, there was Colonel Bud Anderson who flew a P-51 Mustang called Old Crow, and you see a lot of pictures of it. A lot of the surviving P-51 Mustang airplanes are painted as Old Crow, and very, very nice paint job, you know, had some checkers and a few things on there. It showed that kind of that aviation art that wasn't bomber nose art. It was done on a fighter, and it kind of showed how those were kind of flamboyant and painted up. Well, Old Crow, they've done a new Mustang is no coincidence, but a Ford Mustang has been painted up like Old Crow, the P-51 Mustang. So it's actually a pretty cool car. It's nothing you're going to buy as a daily driver. Number one, it costs $300,000. And number two, you know, it's a little impractical to drive. It's kind of like the Indy Pace cars. Nobody really, you know, the ones that are official Indy Pace car, whether it be a Corvette or something else, nobody really drives those to work every day. That's kind of a car you keep in your garage and maybe take to some sort of events or special occasions or something. But the Old Crow Mustang is really pretty interesting because it's kind of like these, you see Car Arms has done it with the Auto Ordinance 1911s. They've come out with this, it's not a retro, it's the retro 1911 A1, even though it's done on Series 80 mechanicals, but it's, they put these kind of vintagey finishes on it where it's got, you know, the plain insignia, and it kind of looks like it's engraved into the metal, and they've got pinup girls and flags, and you know, it's all done in that kind of brushy aluminum chromey look, you know, and kind of distressed a little bit. So, you know, they look very cool and they look very compelling. I come from a place where if it doesn't enhance the performance of the gun, do you really want it? And it's a hard decision because sometimes we put grips on things because we like the way they look and we like to have nicer looking grips on things. So, you know, it's not outrageous to have this. I think that it's something that will never really gain in value. And I mean, the one I saw, and this was probably top retail, but they wanted almost $1,000 for the basically what amounts to the $500 auto ordnance pistol that's been dressed up like this. And I don't see the real market for that. I mean, people who want an authentic looking World War II gun aren't going to buy it. People who want something commemorative, you know, unfortunately the World War II generation is too old. If this had come out 25 years ago, 30 years ago, there might have been more of a interest from guys who were actually in the war and wanted it. I imagine somebody now, the target has got to be just people who are history buffs who are into that particular period in history, or maybe their fathers or grandfathers were in it and they want something with a connection to that time frame, more than just a 1911, an authentic looking 1911 A1. They want something actually that bespeaks of the art and of some of those times. So I don't know. I think they've also done Thompsons like that. You know, over the years they've always had, you know, whatever commemorative Thompson done by some historical society type deal where they put out a limited edition, they charge you $2,000, and face it, you know, the gold plated cuts compensator, the gold trigger, and you know, the gold magazine release. Yeah, I mean, if it's your cup of tea, it's your cup of tea, but generally those things do not hold value, even getting back what you put into them. An acquaintance of mine, they had some done out in Missouri for Clay County, and they had the Clay County commemorative gun. And Clay County is a very historical place. The James gang operated here. The James family lived here. All kinds of other things also. But so it's a very, very historical place. But essentially, unless you get a gun like that, and it's a Winchester, I think it's a 94, Unless you have a gun like that and keep it in pristine condition with all the original boxes, papers, and all that stuff, you don't have a prayer of recouping your money. You just don't, because they just don't command that much. And they're not a gun you would even take out and shoot very much. I had an 1866 Winchester commemorative years and years and years ago, and I wound up trading it off. I mean, I didn't pay what it even sold for new, and although I liked it, it was just apparent to me that this thing was never the finish on that particular gun that I had was never going to last, even very gentle, moderate handling. It was meant for display, really. It wasn't meant for any kind of shooting or anything. And it was a cool gun. I think it had an octagon barrel and a few things. It was a very cool gun, but it just wasn't going to be a gun that you could take out and even use moderately or even lightly. So that's kind of the interesting part of that. A lot of these, there's a lot of World War II things that aren't necessarily something you would have seen in World War II, but they harken back to that time frame. And the old Crow Mustang, Ford Mustang, and the auto ordnance pistols are definitely on that. And you can go to their website and see them. They're interesting, and they're strangely compelling, but I just couldn't see myself buying them. I mean, I think there's just too much else out there that I'd rather have. Okay, Donald Trump pulverizing the Gang of Four, or the squad, I guess they call themselves. And it's, what's her name, Ilhan Tlaib, Presley, and Ocasio-Cortez. You know, these people are children. They're running around, they're calling the president a racist. They called the Speaker of the House a racist. You know, and it shows you how empty of an insult and how empty of a threat or a pejorative that is now, because they're calling everybody a racist. You disagree with them, you're a racist, you know. Now, I will admit, he pulverized him pretty hard, and it's not the tact I would have taken, but he didn't back down, you know. These people fundamentally don't like America. This squad does not like America. They've made it plain. I mean, and they don't like Israel. They don't like America. They want to do some change that even the most radical Democrats probably aren't very comfortable with. Certainly, the Democratic Party is at wit's end with these people. But we, you know, because there's some sort of kook quota for Congress where every weirdo has to get some sort of identity politic deal in there, this is what you get. You get these unruly fools that are not interested in making any kind of laws. They're interested in name-calling. They're interested in attacking Israel. You know, these people are genuinely angered by the war on terror. They're genuinely angered that we want to defend ourselves. And they're genuinely angered when you buy a gun and basically say, hey, it's not going to happen to me. It's not going to happen to me. So they definitely do not like you. And a lot of their views, unfortunately, fit with what the Democratic Party has become. I don't think Nancy Pelosi wants to turn you over to terrorists, but her policies will eventually do that. Same thing with whichever one of the knuckleheads, winds up getting the nomination, whether it's old hair plug Biden or even creaky old Bernie Sanders, or, you know, if Harris is the same way, and Warren actually comes out and says it, oh yeah, I want an 800% increase in immigrants. What kind of country do you have then? And everybody gets free health care, everybody gets something free off the government. That is a country you won't recognize anymore. You won't have disposable income. There'll be no reason to talk about gun rights, because we won't have any money to spend on them, because they're going to tax us like crazy. They're going to take everything away. There won't be two cars in every garage. There, you know, home values will have to plummet, because no one will have money to buy homes. So it could be probably the largest economic disaster the country could face. I mean, you know, really even a, it's hard to think of anything except in, you know, kind of the Man in the High Castle situation where the Axis powers invade mainland America. It's hard to think of anything else that could just bring the nation to its knees. And if you do an 800%, you open the southern border and then have an 800% increase in refugees that are coming from other places, you don't have a country in 5 years. I don't know what you have, but it's going to be, the change would be the greatest single social change that's ever happened to the United States. And I don't think we deserve that. And I mean, it's going to be, redistribution of wealth would be an understatement. I mean, they'll take everything from us and give it in programs to people who can just pour in the over the border, taking everything you've worked for your entire life, everything you've worked for in, you know, your entire lifetime. It's going to be fantastic. And it's, your children will have no future because there's no place for them to go. There's no education system left. There's no anything left. So, and there's going to be no good jobs to have. Even if you have a high-end job, you could be the best heart surgeon or brain surgeon in the country. You could be the best at anything in the country. And yet you're going to live, if you live what is today a middle-class existence, you would be very lucky. Because there won't be a middle class anymore. It'll be destroyed. And so you'll have some haves, like, and Elizabeth Warren is a have. She's always been a have. And then you're going to have all of the rest of us have-nots. And some of the have-nots will work to support society and some won't. If this sounds like the Soviet Union, that's what it is. That's what the Soviet Union couldn't sustain that. Couldn't sustain it at all. Imagine, you know, the policies these people have just would do that. So I'd be very, very, very careful. If you don't like Trump's style, understand that these people are infinitely worse. And what he essentially says about them will bear out to be true, because a lot of things he said have borne out to be true. Okay, if you looked at the latest copy of American Handgunner, I won't go through the articles, but hey, they're definitely going old school guns on it. A lot of revolver articles, a lot of kind of, I won't say nostalgia articles, but, you know, they definitely have kind of just tipped away, at least in this issue, from, you know, the latest polymer Wonder 9, which is like every other polymer Wonder 9. You know, I mean, the one thing that you can say about all these polymer frame guns is that they all are alike. You know, it started really with the Glock, and people have cloned and they've changed it slightly. Some people cloned it a little too well. Smith & Wesson, I think, lost a lawsuit over the Sigma because it was too close a copy of the Glock. But, you know, they fundamentally all work the same. They fundamentally are designed the same. And, you know, striker-fired polymer frame. And, you know, they always struggle to explain why one is better than another. And, you know, so it gets down to, well, it's got a little better trigger. It's got a little better ergonomics, meaning the Glock is like holding a 2x4. You know, it's got a little bit better here, a little bit better there. Maybe the controls are a little more accessible, but the bottom line is they're not that much different. And I don't know that they've become anything more than, you know, it's like going and saying, well, which grease gun is better? Asking an auto mechanic, which grease gun is better? Well, they're all basically the same. This one's got a nicer finish. This one has got a little bit larger handle. You know, whatever it is. But in the final analysis, it's still a grease gun that you're going to put grease on the parts of your car with. So, you know, it fundamentally is the same way with these polymer pistols. They're all essentially the same thing. And in fact, you know, I look at a lot of guns. I do online and even in person. And man, unlike the old days when you could tell a Colt revolver from a Smith 25 feet away, you know, because the silhouette was different and all that. And even though they were both revolvers, I mean, you could tell the difference between a Colt Python and an L-framed Smith & Wesson. You just could. And Now you've got to get right up close and read writing on the, oh, that's an H&K, or oh, that's an FN, or oh, that's a Glock. Glocks look a little more, they're a little easier to identify, but they're still out there. I mean, think, it's still a, you know, they're still all the same. So it was nice to see Handgunner go old school. And of course they had, we talked about in the Gravis Extreme a couple of casts ago, and they have Masad Ayoub. He kind of always contributes and does something there. So it was very, very, a very, very good one. Very good issue. And so it's worth picking up. Not too many gun magazines are, but that one was worth picking up. Okay, we have Facebook. You know, they've got, I don't like Facebook. I'm on it, but I don't like it. It's the only value I see in Facebook is very blunt. If you have a friend who, I've got old roommates from years ago that, hey, we're Facebook friends. I send them a message once in a while. Wish them a happy birthday over Facebook. Yeah, that's fine. I do like some of the groups, though. Unfortunately, the ones in my interest area, which are military, history, and then GASP, firearms, you know, those kind of get heavily regulated, and, you know, they shut them down for whatever reason. And, you know, it's all childish stuff. So I'm not a real fan of Facebook. I'm not a real fan of all that. There is, though, a good Smith & Wesson revolver group that I think is, you know, the pictures are worth it. Definitely, you know, people give descriptions of the various Smith & Wesson revolvers, and I like that. So that's a really good group to just watch, good one to join. There's also, you know, groups for whatever interest, but have to be very, very careful. Some of them, oddly, some of them say, well, don't ever, you know, you have to put not for sale on every post that shows a picture or something. And then other ones say, don't do that because we assume that every post is not for sale. I don't know. I don't post that. I don't really put pictures up. It's just not worth it. You know, it isn't worth playing with, you know, play stupid games, win stupid prizes. And with Facebook, you can win stupid prizes. And I'm kind of done with it. You know, I would be surprised in 5 years there won't be a Facebook. They're coming under federal scrutiny. And they just found out with this Border Patrol thing, they had a lot of, I think, retired and maybe a few current kind of Border Patrol or ICE people in a closed group, which they've got all kinds of closed groups. And now they're turning that all over. So just because it's a closed group doesn't mean Facebook, anything you put on there is going to be public record forever, and they can use it against you. So that's why you shouldn't join or post any kind of nonsense on there. Okay, let's go to my favorite part of this podcast, which is questions and answers. So here we go. We got some questions coming in. What is your favorite firearms lubricant? You know, that's a very interesting question, and one that I've wrestled with over the years. And for the most part, what I used was over-the-counter, you know, stuff. Everything from CLP to oil to, you know, just gun oil put out by a bunch of different people. And we're talking about lubricants here. Then, you know, there was always different companies putting out the grease. I always put a thing that if it slides, you grease it. If it turns and moves, you kind of oil it. So, but after going through all of this over and over, and some of this stuff gets to be really high priced. You get a 5-ounce bottle and it's going to cost you $10, you know, because it's some super secret formula that only so many guys have come up with and all that. Well, you know, not being too observant, but being slightly observant, I noticed that some of this really high speed stuff had a purple look to it, you know, and I thought, what, I wonder what the bases are for that. You know, what is the basis for that? And the answer, I'm pretty sure, is it's, you know, essentially synthetic motor oil. Not petroleum-based, but synthetic motor oil. And when you look at Mobil 1 grease and Mobil 1 oil, synthetic motor oil, don't get the petroleum base, but the synthetic, it has that same purpley hue. So not being Sherlock Holmes, but not being, you know, completely blind, I basically said this is probably what they're using. So for a long time, I've actually used those two products, and I found them to be at least the equal of all this other stuff that you can buy out there. You know, I just is. And, you know, I did have a tiny background in this. For a short time, I worked for an air gun retailer. And these guys sold precision air guns. And this is going back. But they used to sell the little tiny bottles, you know, of this stuff for a few bucks a piece, you know, $3 or $4 a piece, whatever it was. But, you know, I would watch, they had a technician who, this guy was also the janitor. This guy was the janitor. And they would tell him, hey, you know, go back and mix up another batch of this stuff. So they had a guy who didn't even, had no scientific training or anything. He just knew that, you know, you add this much of this and this much of that, and he put it, and they had it in like a little cement mixer thing, and it mixed it all up. I mean, this was not high speed. This was not like, you know, it was being turned out of Stark Laboratories, you know. So this was just really low speed. And then they would put it in these little bottles. They bought these little bottles. They slapped a label on it, and they'd sell these things for $3 or $4 a piece. And, you know, they were very, very, you know, closed about it. Even the janitor wouldn't talk about what these things he was adding is. But clearly it was industrial kind of stuff that you could get. And basically anybody could have made this on their own. And you have to be careful with air guns. You can't use anything petroleum based because it'll diesel. The temperatures of air guns with the compressed air get so high that anything that's holding some petroleum will ignite, and they call that dieseling. It doesn't create a big flame or anything, but it just burns right off. So I knew that this boutique-y stuff and when the war on terror started, everybody had their own little formulation of this, that, and the other thing. I knew that a bunch of this boutique-y stuff was all BS, that this was whatever synthetic compounds they could get, they could mix it together, and then they could just create whatever they wanted to. And to me, the dead giveaway was kind of the purpley look that I'd seen in the synthetic motor oil. So really, for about $8, $7, $8, whatever it costs, it's more expensive, about twice what a regular quart of oil would cost. You just buy a quart of synthetic Mobil 1 and buy a tube of their grease, and they'll last you for years. But I've used it on guns, and I've had no problem, no unusual wear. It sticks on there very, very well. It seems to work exceptionally well. It's easy to clean off. I mean, it's good stuff, and that's really my favorite thing, and that's what I would pass on. And I know that there's other things. There's Ed's Red Boar Cleaner and all kinds of stuff that are home brews. I don't even mix this with anything. I just use it straight, and hey, it works great. And you know, I've had a quart thing of this for a while, and you know, it'll last several, probably last 2 or 3 years, depending on how many guns you're doing, how often you do it, and all that. But it's not rocket science. And a lot of this stuff people want to sell is simply their own concoction of this kind of stuff. You know, it's up to you. You can pay $6 for 6 ounces, or you can pay $7 for about 50 ounces, and you know, or even more. So that's what I use, and I don't give the fakers my money. I just don't. Okay, next one. What are your favorite pistol powders for hand loading? And it depends what you're hand loading. I've used all kinds. You know, I do use HP 38 and 231 for target loads. I really like that. I've used them forever. 231's been around forever. HP 38, in case you didn't know, is the same powder. It just has a different labeling. So you can use the same charges and everything, same data as 231. Those are probably my favorite because I just have used them in 38 and 45 for more years than I'd like to admit. I use Unique in some loads. I've always liked Unique, really because it came out in like 1898 or something. It's cool. It's like, you know, it's smokeless powder, but it really harkens back to a time when people were kind of first loading smokeless powder, and it's a very unique as it is unique. I mean, you can use it for all kinds of low powered loads and moderate powered loads in pistols, but you know, they used to you can even use it for, you know, low powered cast bullet kind of plinking loads in 30 caliber rifles. So I do enjoy Unique. I think it's a great powder. 4227 Hodgdon powder is excellent. I've dabbled with Trail Boss. Trail Boss is kind of a cool powder. It's really made for cowboy action shooters, so they wouldn't have the danger of double charging a case. You know, I think when Cass started out, people were using probably 231 and probably Bullseye. That's another great old powder, but you know, the big fear was you would double charge, I think, a Bullseye and blow your gun apart. So they came out with Trail Boss, which it's almost impossible to double load because it'll spill all out of the cartridge. It really uses up a lot of the volume inside of a cartridge, which for 45 Colt, which we were speaking about a little while back, that's really a good feature to have because, you know, the loads will be very consistent. So in 45 Colt, it's very consistent. But I've used it in 45 Auto Rim. It was during the great powder shortage after Sandy Hook. And I wanted some 45 Auto Rim ammo, so I loaded up with Trail Boss. And you know what? It was fine. It was absolutely fine. Basically performed the same way that the 231 and HP 38 did. It comes in, I think it only comes in 7/8 of a pound. It comes in less than a pound can. And you use... it's not as efficient that way. You use a lot more of it, but you know, hey, that's just the way it goes. So it's really a good powder. Okay, what cast lead bullets do you use for hand loading? Well, I prefer to cast my own. With time being what it is, I do buy cast bullets in bulk on occasion. One time I got a really great deal on Spear 148 grain wad cutters. I think it was like $150 for 3,000 rounds. Maybe, no, it was less than that. It was like $125 with shipping for 3,000 rounds. That was a really good deal. So I went ahead and bought those and used them and loaded up a lot of ammunition. Great ammo, great bullet. There's a company called Missouri Bullet Company, which I use. They're not too far away from me, far away enough so that they have to ship, but it's not a big deal. They've come out with something that's very interesting. It's called a K-ball, which is a 233 grain round nose 45 caliber bullet, which the nice part about it is it's got a little bit longer ogive, and it's going to chamber, I think, a lot better in some of the guns I use it for. And that's one of the reasons I got it. Plus they made it a little bit heavier so that when you're using it with a charge for a 230 grain bullet, you know, it'll have just a tiny bit more resistance, which will make it more reliable actually. It'll give the powder a little bit of chance to burn and go. So I'm thinking that that's gonna be a real winner, and I haven't tried them yet. But I've got them, but I haven't tried them, and I'm really looking forward to it because you know, it's when you're using them in semi-automatic guns, it can be. I've turned out 45 softball rounds, which are the 230 grain lead bullets, which are in some guns they work perfectly, work better than military ball ammunition. Other guns don't like them. I mean, and this two 1911s, two different 1911s. One likes it, the other one hiccups with it. I can't figure it out. So, I'm thinking that this improved bullet profile will essentially help me get these things get these things under control and maybe reduce a variable, and maybe all of my all the guns that I would shoot them in would work out just as well. So that's really what I'm looking at. So that's a big one. Let's see. I do sometimes buy specialty bullets. I don't try to cast bullets for 351 Winchester. It's just not worth it. I buy the plated bullets. I think they work out a whole lot better. For Martini Henry, I could cast a 500 grain Lee bullet, but I actually prefer to buy the, there's actually one made specifically for it that Buffalo Arms sells. So actually, I think I got that from Graf. I misspoke. I got it from Graf, and really an excellent bullet. So that's the one I kind of go with, and I don't shoot it enough to really invest in a mold and mold it myself. It's actually probably more cost effective for me, just for the amount that I'm going to shoot them, just to buy 50 or 100, and you know, that's the way that goes. All right. Oh, here's another one. What is the best all-around pistol holster? And the guy who asked me this, he didn't mean pistols and revolvers. He meant pistols as in semi-automatic pistols. And specifically, I think he's really talking about duty pistols. And the answer I have for him is very pedestrian, but it's good. One of the best all-around pistol holsters, and everybody will laugh at this, but it's true, is the Bianchi M12, or the US M12 holster. It's also called the UM84. It basically came in when the Beretta M9 was adopted. And it can be adapted to, you know, you can buy some harness and make a shoulder holster out of it. You can buy a thumb latch thing, take the flap off. The flap will just come right off. And you can make just a thumb brake holster out of it. It's got this little thumb thing that fits on. You can switch it left or right handed, so you can wear it on your belt on either side. Super good holster. It went out of fashion very quickly when the war on terror started. The perception was you could not access the pistol quickly enough. And people went to drop leg holsters and the chest carry. When you see the body armor, that was the other problem, is where do you put this thing when you're wearing the body armor? Well, the chest carry was very convenient because you could just attach a Molly holster to your chest, and it would be up, and when you're inside a vehicle, your hands would be up near your chest, you could pull it out. And that was looked upon as being a pretty optimal solution. It's nothing you could ever use in any kind of an environment other than combat, because when you pull your gun out, the muzzle kind of sweeps a lot, and they'll never tolerate that in a range environment or a match environment. But the, you know, for a good belt holster, the M12 is hard to beat. You can put a 1911 in there, any 1911 size gun, Beretta size gun, you can get in there, and that's no problem. You obviously could not get something much larger like a Desert Eagle or anything like that. Won't even come close. But any duty size handgun you can get in there. And some of the smaller compacts, it may have extra room in it, but you can get those in there too. And the nice part about the M12 is especially when you have the flap still on it, is when you latch it, it's usually pretty solid. That pistol won't go anywhere. It won't bounce out. So even in some of these matches where people are running around and having you do athletic things, the pistol will stay in there and it'll stay put. So that's a nice consideration for the sport aspect. For any other use, it's a good holster. It's durable, it's rugged, it's reliable. And you can, you know, if you practice with it, you can get your gun out pretty quick. I think it kind of got dumped a little too quickly. It was kind of looked upon as just some kind of Cold War relic that wasn't going to be high speed enough or good enough for the war on terror, but in point of fact, I think it was plenty good, and I think in some cases it would have been a wiser choice than some of the drop leg holsters and all that. I used a drop leg holster for 14 months, and frankly, I've never used it again. I mean, it's you know, very specific piece of gear. It worked out fine and everything was all good with it, but I don't know that that's something you could wear every day. And it's certainly nothing you'd want to wear around if you're woods bumming or doing chores out on the back 40 or any place where you'd be kind of carrying a pistol. And, you know, it's not really suited unless you're wearing something made out of parachute silk shirt or something. I don't know that you can find a garment large enough to kind of cover it so you could carry it concealed. But I suppose on some level you could figure out how to do that. But if you're wearing a giant coat, you could probably carry the pistol in that. But it is going to stick out. It's meant for durability, reliability. It was never designed for concealment. But it's a good holster, very, very well made and good. And the good part about those is, the very cool part about those is that they are for sale on places like eBay and probably GunBroker. You can get one for $20. And I mean, you can't beat that. You go to the Safariland website and a new version, a brand new one, will cost you $92. So the $20 slightly used one on eBay is and I've seen them as cheap as $15 on eBay. Are they brand new? No, but you know, hey, it's worth it. You know, especially if you got a couple different holsters to buy. I mean, you know, I don't know what preppers use, but people I know who carry service pistols in their prepping mode when they're at their retreat locations or whatever. Hey, if you got to buy six holsters, you could get into that for $120 as opposed to, you know, whatever ungodly amount of money they want to charge. I see these Kydex plastic holsters that you wear on your belt, the same as an M12. You'd wear that in the same place, and they're basically $40-$50. And some of those look like the cheapest pieces of junk. You know, they're going to have hard, sharp edges and a lot of things. So I'm sitting there going, hey, a simple solution that works, is economical, and is really battle-proven, I think works out just as well. May not be the highest speed thing out there, but it's gonna basically do you well to get into it. Okay, here's a related one. Actually, the next two are related. Best tactical rifle slings. And I wouldn't have the foggiest idea. Somewhere in my basement, there is a box which contains probably two or three of these things. Some of them have been given to me. I have never found one of these slings that's worth a hoot. I've just never have. I mean, I have to tell you that I know there are guys who would go out there and sell them, and you know, you can go down the list of the famous names who've developed these slings. The failing all of them have are, number one, they're too complex. You know, I'm not Houdini. I'm not going to try to, you know, slither in and out of this thing, and this buckle goes forward. I'm telling you, when you're actually out there using these things, whether it's in a match or something more serious, fumbling with these goofball slings is not what you want to do. Now, maybe you can get advice from somebody more high speed than me who can do that, but I'm a regular guy, and I'm telling you, don't do it. It's a mistake. And I know there are a lot of guys, Delta Force and SEAL Team 6 guys, and everybody's got their own. The problem I've had with them is, if you're wearing any kind of gear, like a tack vest or anything else, those things get tangled in your magazine pouches. They're always in the way. They're always uncomfortable. And they're designed to do, really what you want these slings to do, is if your primary weapon goes down and you have to drop it, you want it just kind of hang in front of you and you can transition to a sidearm. Or you can drop the weapon in front of you and you can use your two hands to manage some other situation, whether it's, you know, manipulating some equipment, or whether it's going hand to hand with somebody, or whatever the reason is that you need two free hands and you've got a rifle in your hands, and it's nice to be able to drop it and it just kind of falls to a natural 45-degree angle with the butt up near your shooting shoulder. With me, it's my right shoulder because I'm right-handed. And then I can do whatever I need to do with my two hands, and then I basically can pick up the rifle and use the pistol grip and the forearm, and there I'm back in business. Or if your gun jams and, hey, you know, you need to keep doing fire. It's, if you make the value judgment that it's going to be faster to transition than it is to try to figure out why this thing's no worky, then that's what you do. And then, you know, you still have your rifle on you. You haven't dropped it in the dirt. It isn't gone. I kind of use something that I've used for a long time, which is a Surplus GI M60 sling. And I tape it. I take 100-mile-an-hour tape, and I get it to be the right size that I need it to be. And I tape that bad boy, and that's what I use. And I basically manipulate it such that the wide part, the big wide part on the deal, is what's kind of going across my back and my shoulder, and the rest of it is the rest of it. And is it a perfect solution? No. Does it work? Yes. Does it stay untangled from anything else I'm carrying? Yes. So that's all I'm looking for. But as far as if you want to go with the rest of them, it's fine. These guys are all, let me tell you something, they'll sell you that stuff all day long. And then they'll say that the one they've designed this year is better than the one they had last year. Because their job is to get money out of your pocket, not necessarily put the best sling on you and your rifle. So be very careful with that. For the law enforcement guys, I don't even know what to say. I mean, there's so much of that out there. They can go after what your department says to use or what your friends have found out. But to my mind, a simple two-point sling, and like I said, I adjust it where I want it, and then I tape the snot out of it to make sure it stays that way. And like I said, it doesn't look pretty, but it works, and that's what I use. Ballistic helmets. Okay, like they used to call them Mitch helmets, advanced combat helmets, and there's different iterations of these things, and some of them got little gizmos on the side where you can mount radios, and they've got rhino horns on the front so you can put your nods and all of this. And we've seen these. These came out War on Terror. They replaced the old Kevlar PSAGT helmet, you know, they replaced that. And the nice part about them is that you can hear. You can actually hear somebody. The old Kevlar covered your ears, so, you know, you had to pay attention with communications, and you couldn't mount really much on the Kevlar. So these helmets do a great job. They protect your head. They do all that kind of stuff. I don't think they really have much value to a civilian shooter other than the cool factor look. And if you're carrying a few extra pounds on your body, be careful about putting a bunch of tack gear on your body, because you will look like a Ninja Turtle and you will look silly. You won't look high speed. You'll look silly. So unless you need a helmet, I actually wouldn't go for it. I know that I've seen the in-range TV things, and they have some armored and armored plus categories where you got to carry all that crap plus your ammo and everything. Frankly, I'm kind of done with that because I carried it for 14 months, and I'm done carrying that. You know, it's a good piece of equipment, and if you need the protection, it's there. It's really not a crash helmet. It's a ballistic helmet, and you know, it's there, and it does what it does. So, you know, there's, all I would say is if you buy one, make sure you buy a quality one. There's a lot of knockoffs and I'm sure other stuff out there now that looks good but may not be good. It's just like body armor, you know. If you just want it for looks and you just want it to kind of, you know, haul around with on the range or something, that's one thing. But if there's even the slightest chance you might seriously use this stuff, then go out and buy the real stuff and, you know, train in it. And you'll learn a lot about your equipment, and you'll learn a lot about you, because that stuff will wear you out. And, you know, you'll see that definitely you have your limitations, but you'll also get the protection. But, you know, it's a trade-off. You're a lot less, I won't say a lot less, but you feel less mobile. You feel more protected, but you're less mobile. You feel less agile. You feel less like you can, you know, chase somebody down. Now, the good part is, if you go hand-to-hand with somebody who's not wearing anything, you know, any of this kind of gear, guess what? You now probably outweigh him by something, you know, because these things weigh like 25, 30 pounds. You got the helmet, which is 4 or 5 pounds, whatever those things weigh. And, you know, part of the strategy is if you can fall on top of them, you're going to hurt them. You're going to hurt them. If you can knock them down and land on top of them, you're going to take that dude out, because all of a sudden you are on top. You've got so much more weight on top of him than just your body. You know, he's not going to do some Chuck Norris cheetah flip and flip you off into the air or something. You've got him pinned. So, you know, understand that, and you know, you can try wrestling around in some of that to maybe get a sense of it and not really hurt somebody. But, you know, you can try that, you know, just sitting on your back and wrestling, and just see that, hey, this stuff is really heavy. The difference between me without it and me with it is huge. So, you know, that stuff is there. There's also, when it comes to, like, body armor, even though this question was more about helmets, you know, there's still some of those old GI flak jackets out there. And while I don't think that they're really particularly very good for anything, because, yeah, they might stop a pistol bullet. They were designed to stop fragments, and there's no guarantee they'll stop anything else. You know, you can repurpose some of that protective gear. I knew a guy who made basically made seat covers out of them for his vehicle. And he says, hey, if somebody's shooting at me, you know, let's say they shoot through the back of my Jeep. Well, the bullet's got to pass through all that. Then it's going to hit this, and it's going to hit one side of it. It's going to go through the seat, and then it's going to hit the other side of this. And he goes, that might be enough to save me. That might be enough to do it, especially if it's a pistol. You know, may not even get through the first layer. But essentially, if you got these things around your seats the way they would be around a person, you've got, all of a sudden, you got a double layer there, which you know, could slow a bullet down. Plus, it's passing through different mediums, and that always you know, siphons energy off a bullet. So, you know, there are some other purposes you could probably use these things for. That was just the one that came to mind, and you know, it's kind of interesting. So, anyway, this is Old School Guns, and we were talking about helmets, we were talking about body armor and all that stuff, and that's just my thoughts on it. But if you like what you heard, please press the follower button and press the like button. And if you press the follower button, you'll get advance notice when the next episode posts. So please like us. Remember, we're beholding to no one. We're the Wolfman Jack of a gun podcast. We're beholding to no one. We're kind of these bandits who are out there, and you and the audience are part of the bandit nation that's out there. Anyway, thank you for listening. This is Old School Guns out.